Please turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 13, and the reading is from verse 31 to 33, and then 44 to 50. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all the seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants. It becomes a tree, so the birds of the air can come and perch in its branches. He told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into a large amount of flour until it worked all the way through the dough. Verse 44. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for a pearl. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. Once again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was let down into the lake and caught all kinds of fish. When it was full, the fishermen pulled it up on the shore. Then they sat down and collected the good fish in the basket, but threw the bad away. This is how it will be the end of the age. The angels will come and separate the wicked from the righteous and throw them into the fiery furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. This is the word of God.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for your warm welcome. It's really exciting to be here at Castle Hill Baptist for the first time. And really exciting for me as someone who with my family spent the last 10 years partnering with churches to see the gospel go out. It's exciting for me to turn up on Mission Emphasis this week and see those nine missionary units that you're partnering with. So just want to encourage you to continue in that work. Now, I had some slides. I wonder if the... Yes. I'll stick the first one up here. This is a photo of me chatting to a guy back in Southeast Asia where we used to live. I'm going to tell you the story of the time I met this guy. So about a 1 hour's drive from the house where we lived in our city. We lived in a big city of about 8 million people. About a 1 hour's drive from there was an active volcano. And so this was our go-to place if ever we had guests who came to see us. You could drive up to the top of this active volcano and park right on the top crater and peek in and see the bubbling, sort of steaming, what was going on in there. And then if you had the time, you could hire a guide and you could walk down the side of the volcano to the second smaller crater. And that one was even more fun because there was lots of little bubbling hot springs and you could stick your feet in them. You could boil an egg in some of the hotter ones and there was vents with steam coming up everywhere. It was like a scene out of Mordor and Lord of the Rings or something, but it was great. I used to love going there. And one of the times that we went, not long before we finished up at the beginning of last year, we hired a guide, and this was the guide that you can see me chatting to there. And as we walked down the side of the volcano, we saw evidence of some kind of sacrifices or spiritual activity that some of the locals had been doing. The background is that even though it was a Muslim area, 99.9% of the local people group were Muslim. It was also an area that was very animist, so traditional spiritual practices, witch doctors, that kind of thing. And so it was obvious that people had come along to this place and done some kind of offerings just from what was left over and incense and things like that. Mountains are often thought of in traditional religion as a place of spiritual power because they're closer to the heavens. So I asked the guide about that. I said, what are these things about? And he said, oh, people come here because we're up high on a mountain to make offerings, to get protection, to get power, to get good fortune from the good spirits. And also protection from the bad spirits, get help from the good spirits, from the bad spirits. And I said, are you afraid of the bad spirits? And he said, yeah, everyone's afraid of the bad spirits. Do you make offerings? Do you do things like that as well? And he said that he did. Then I asked him, what if God had done something to give you complete protection and freedom from bad spirits. Would you want to know about that? And he said, yeah, of course I would. So I asked him, could I tell you a story from my holy books? And he agreed. And then as we walked down the mountain, I told him the story of the time that Jesus met the demon-possessed man at the Gerasenes. The demons identified themselves as Legion. And I told this story and I said, when Jesus met that man and those spirits confronted him, it wasn't that Jesus was afraid of the spirits like everyone is here. It was the other way around. The spirits were afraid of Jesus. And I told how Jesus freed the man from those spirits and how I told this gentleman, if you were to follow Jesus, if you were to accept Jesus as the Lord of your life, you could have the same freedom and protection from spirits as that man experienced that day. Would you be interested in something like that? And he said, oh, yes, I certainly would. We kept chatting. It's about a 40-minute walk, and we chatted about a range of things. And after a while, I started to ask him about sin. So even though he was clearly animist in the fact that he was interested in spirits and witchcraft and that kind of thing, like most people, he was also Muslim, so sort of a mixture of those two things. So I said, you're a Muslim, right? He said, yes. I said, well, I'm a follower of Jesus, and I understand that we have something in common, and that is that we believe one day we're going to face God in judgment, and unless our sin problem has already been dealt with by then, we'll be in a lot of trouble. We'll miss out on heaven. Is that right? You believe that like I do? And he said, yes, I do. So I said, can you tell me what it is you're doing now to see that your sin problem is dealt with by then? And he told me what all Muslims would tell me when I asked that question. He said, oh, well, I go to the mosque as often as I can. I pray. I fast, especially during the fasting month. I give money to the poor. And he just listed a list of things that he's been taught to do and that he does do. I asked him if he thought that would be enough. And he said he hoped so. And then I said, what if it's not? In the holy books that describe the life of Jesus, it teaches that no good deeds, none of those things that you listed could ever be enough to completely deal with our sin debt. But in those same holy books, there's a story, there's a message that God has acknowledged that, and God has sent someone who can deal with our sin debt, and that's Jesus, and that's why Jesus died on the cross. And then we talked for 10 or 15 minutes about why Jesus died on the cross, so that our sins could be paid for, our sin debt could be cancelled. I said, if that was true, if your sin debt could be cancelled, would you want to know more about that? And he said, yes, of course. Anyway, we finally arrived at the destination. I gave him my phone number, and I wrote down my name and my phone number. I said, if you want to learn more about this man who can not only free you from the danger of evil spirits, but also from your sin debt for all eternity, give me a call and I can put you in touch with a local follower of Jesus who can tell you more about that. So I went home optimistic, excited, awaiting the call, but he never called. You thought it was going to be one of those positive missionary stories, didn't you? He never called. Now, I had, at the time, I was teaching evangelism at the mission training school. So we'd have local believers who were going to become church planters in the unreached people groups of our country. There were 127 unreached people groups in our country, and 34 of those were unengaged unreached people groups, meaning there were no missionaries or Christians there at all. So we'd have students, we'd be training them up to go to places like that and share the gospel and, God willing, plant small churches, plant growing churches. So I was teaching evangelism at this missionary training school, and the conversation I had with this guy, it seemed to me like I'd done everything according to the theory, everything that I was supposed to do. I'd started by identifying a felt need, that was his fear of the spirits, and I'd showed him that the gospel could have something really exciting to offer him there. I'd used storytelling, which connected with his learning style. He was an oral person, not someone who would read, and so I'd use stories. And eventually we talked about the cross and how the cross was the centre of it all and could change his eternity. And I'd finished by giving him my phone number, which is a big rule in our evangelism class. I always give them an opportunity to take it further and meet you again. feels like I'd done everything I was supposed to do, and yet he never called. The whole thing seems to have led to nothing. And so that story illustrates what I want us just to think about this morning as part of your mission emphasis week. I want us to think about this thing. As kingdom people, as people on mission for God, our task is to do kingdom work, to invite people into the kingdom, to carry out God's mission. But, and here's what I want us to be thinking about, sometimes kingdom work is hard, isn't it? Sometimes it seems to lead to nothing, or it seems to lead to rejection or being ignored. In fact, sometimes it leads to worse than that. Sometimes it can lead to trouble. So in my evangelism class, when I was teaching at both schools, actually, I taught evangelism, and this one of the assignments I would always give students was to go and find someone who wasn't a believer, which wasn't hard when 99.9% of the population was Muslim. Go and find someone who's not a believer and share the gospel with them, and then write a report on how it went and what you learnt from the experience. One of my students, in the last time I set that assignment, he described in his report that he was on a bus travelling to a nearby city, decided it was a good time to do his evangelism homework, started telling the good news. The man he was sitting next to got really angry. He stood up and started yelling at him, and everyone on the bus stopped and looked at them. He became really physically aggressive and threatening. "Don't you dare talk to me about Jesus." Eventually my student said he apologised if there was any offence, and he got off at the next bus stop, and that was it. Sorry, I should have showed you. That was the particular student who had that experience. And so, like I said before, our task as kingdom people is to do kingdom work. But kingdom work can be hard. Sometimes it leads to being ignored or rejected, like I had that experience. But like this guy experienced, sometimes it can even lead to threats of trouble or worse. Another story to illustrate this. This guy, I'll call him Anto. He was a student at the School of Mission, and he graduated from that. And he went out to become a full-time church planter. And his first few months of telling the gospel in a strongly Muslim area, there was a couple that came to faith. And he made an arrangement with them to come back. It was a few hours from where he lived. Come back in a couple of weeks' time, to sort of follow them up, to begin the discipleship process after they'd heard the gospel. They'd made a response, but it was time for them to go deeper and learn and grow and start that discipleship process. When he turned up at the time they'd arranged, there was a whole group of angry men waiting out the front of their house, and they said, "If you ever come back here, we'll kill you." Now, I'll tell a bit more of his story later on, but for now I just want us to notice our task is to do kingdom work, but kingdom work can be hard, can't it? It can lead to being ignored or made fun of, but it can even lead to trouble, it can even lead to threats, persecution. And so the question I want to ask you is, what impact does this have on you? What impact does this have on us? The fact that kingdom work, that mission, which is what we're especially focusing on here in Mission Emphasis Week, the fact that that can be hard, what impact does that have on you? This is another student of mine. When we had the evangelism assignment and to do that report on your experience of telling the gospel, I'll call this guy Aldo. When it was time to collect assignments, Aldo didn't hand one in. And when I went and asked Aldo, "You haven't handed your assignment in. What's going on?" He said, "I didn't do it." I said, "Why didn't you do it?" And he said, "I'm scared. I'm scared of what might happen if I do it." So because kingdom work is hard, because it might lead to rejection or to trouble, that can lead us to hold back, can't it? It can lead us to play it safe. It can lead us to responding to this command by Jesus to do mission. It can lead us to responding to that by holding back, to Aldo's type of response. Now, before we left Southeast Asia, I sold our car to someone, and then when we arrived in Australia, I started to get some WhatsApp messages from him saying, "This car is no good. It's driving, but it's not driving the way it was when I test drove it before you sold it to me. And I felt terrible. I'm back in Australia, too late to do anything. I thought, oh no, I've sold him a lemon. It was fine when I had it, but I felt really bad. But he sent some photos of the car along with his message. And I noticed in one of the photos that the handbrake light was on. And so I said to him, just try it with the handbrake down. And then he wrote back a little while later, yeah, it works fine now, it works fine now. So, that's the only time in my life I've ever given good advice on cars, because I'm hopeless with cars, but I was good enough to understand that problem. I wonder, with kingdom work, if it can be a little bit like the experience of driving a car with a handbrake on. Are we comfortable enough with each other to admit who's ever done this before, driven the car with a handbrake on? Am I the only one that's ever tried? Okay, there's a few, that's good. It goes, doesn't it? It goes, but it's not good. It's not how the car was designed to drive, is it? And I wonder if our experience can be a little bit like that, if we're allowing the fear of trouble and persecution to hold us back in mission. I wonder if this kind of process might happen. Rejection, trouble, or fear of rejection, fear of trouble, lead to this kind of fear like Aldo with the who didn't do the assignment, or doubt, maybe doubt that we're backing the right horse. Is God really God if I'm having all this trouble? And the solution might be handbrake Christianity, holding back from what we've been commanded to do. Because we have these radical commands from Jesus, don't we? These radical commands to make disciples, to love self-sacrificially, to be giving, to be praying, to be telling, to be going, to be... We have these amazing commands. But when rejection, trouble, suffering is there, it can lead us to hold back, to play it safe, to drive with the handbrake on. How about for you? Can you identify with that process? Can you see that process having played out in your life before? Now, since we've got back to Australia just a little over a year ago, having lived and served somewhere else for 10 years, I've just been making a point of asking people as I've travelled around, what's it like being a Christian in Australia these days compared to 10 years ago when I was last living here in Australia? And I get the same kind of answers from WA over across here to New South Wales, getting very similar answers. People say things like, it's really hard to be a Christian in Australia these days. It's really hard. We're under attack. We're considered as the bad guys now. You can't share your faith in Australia anymore. People don't want to hear. So in other words, the kind of answers I'm getting are rejection and trouble, right? And my question is, does that have an impact on you leading to fear or to doubt or to handbrake Christianity? Well, if the answer is yes, if you can identify with that process in any way, then Matthew 13 is what you need. Matthew 13 is what we need. The people who are following Jesus in Matthew 13, it seems that they were grappling with the same kinds of things. Because if you read Matthew 13 in context, leading up to chapter 13, there's been rejection and there's been trouble for Jesus and for Jesus' followers. If you've got a Bible there and you just want to flick through the chapters leading up to it, you can see back in chapter 11 there was trouble. John the Baptist is put into prison. How did that happen? What does that lead to? Well, it seems to lead to doubt. He sends this message to Jesus. Are you really the one? I thought you were the one, but now here I am, the one, the prophet that prepared the way for you, and I'm in prison. It leads to doubt. And in chapter 11, we also have rejection. The people of Chorazin, the people of Bethsaida, they reject Jesus. And then in chapter 12, we have more rejection. The religious leaders, they reject Jesus. They oppose Jesus. They attack Jesus. So you imagine if you're his follower, if you're his disciple, you're following him around, you're seeing all this trouble and rejection, these crowds, these disciples are probably thinking, is Jesus really the one? Should I really risk all for this guy? Well, maybe I should just apply the handbrake. Maybe I should play it safe. So Jesus seems to know that's what they might be thinking, given what's going on. And so in Matthew 13, he devotes this time to telling a series of parables. And the essence of what he communicates in these parables is this. He says, you need to understand what the kingdom is really like. See, if you get that wrong, you will hold back. You might not even follow me at all, but you'll be holding back. You'll be playing it safe. You'll have the handbrake on. But if you get it right, if you understand what the kingdom is really like, then you'll be unleashed to live handbrake off Christianity, unleashed mission, unleashed discipleship, unleashed obedience. So you and I, we need to know what the kingdom is like. If we're going to be followers of Jesus, carrying out Jesus' mission, we need to know what the kingdom is like. So what is it like? That's going to be our focus this morning. And we're going to look through, I think it's about five parables in the second half of chapter 13. We're going to look through where Jesus tells us what the kingdom is like through these parables. And we're going to see three big things. The first one is this. It's hidden. What's the kingdom like? It's hidden now. It's hidden now. Let's look at the two parables, the short parables that Jesus tells to illustrate this. I'll read from verse 31. Have a look with me. Verse 31 of Matthew 13. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all your seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and perch in its branches. He told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into a large amount of flour until it worked through all the dough. So the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. So it starts small. Starts as something unimpressive, something you can hardly see, something that's not powerful, it's not dominating, it's not apparently in control. Gets planted, but even then, for a time, it's still nothing. At first, it's nothing to see at all, and then something eventually small and weak starts to show. But eventually, what's it going to become? It's going to become the biggest plant of them all. That's what the kingdom is like, says Jesus. Right now it's small, it's unimpressive, but one day when Jesus returns, it's going to dominate the landscape. It's going to be the biggest, most powerful thing. But not yet, not now. Now it's hidden. What it really is, its full glory is hidden. Unless we have the eyes to see. So you can't just tell by looking at it now what it will become. And the second parable teaches the same thing, doesn't it? This time, the kingdom is like yeast. Now, I need to understand that yeast back then wasn't a powder like we might be used to it these days. It was a little bit of fermenting dough, and that little bit of fermenting dough was mixed in or hidden in with the rest of the flour, and it was kneaded. And so Jesus is saying the kingdom of heaven is a bit like that little bit of fermenting dough. At the point when it's mixed into the rest of the flour, it's hidden in with the rest and you can't see it. It's unimpressive. You can't tell that that little bit of dough is going to permeate the whole thing. It's going to affect the whole thing. It's going to control the whole thing, change the whole thing. So from these two pictures, do you see what the kingdom is like? Just like a mustard seed, just like some yeast. It's small right now. It's unimpressive right now. But it will eventually be everything. We can't see that yet. It's hidden now, but it will eventually be everything. Now, you know, I reckon this would have shocked the people, the crowds, the disciples that were listening to Jesus as he spoke these parables. See, they were people who really were waiting for the kingdom. But the kind of kingdom they were waiting for was a King David type of kingdom. See, David, centuries earlier, had established the kingdom of God in Israel by winning wars. He defeated Israel's enemies, he'd taken political control, and he'd enforced God's law in the land. He'd set up God's kingdom in the land by political means. And in the centuries since, that kingdom had been lost, and Israel were now living as servants of other empires, but that's what they were waiting for. They'd been promised this kingdom again. They'd been promised a Messiah who would bring it. But that's what they were waiting for, a King David-type kingdom. And then their expectation was rising and rising when Jesus came along, did amazing miracles, did signs. Their hope was getting higher and higher. And he said he was bringing God's kingdom, and their hope was getting higher and higher. But what's it like? What image is Jesus going to use to describe this mighty kingdom that he's come to establish? Is it going to be like a lion? Is that the image he's going to choose? Or an ox? Or an oak? Some kind of mighty empire image? What's the image he's used? A mustard seed. Or a little bit of fermenting yeast, fermenting dough. It would have come as a big surprise to everyone. The kingdom is hidden now. It's arrived. It's active, it's growing, but it's hidden now. Unless you're a gardener, and I'm not, when you look at a mustard seed, you would have no idea of the big plant that would become. And unless you've got eyes to see, when you look at the kingdom now, you really can't have any idea what it's going to become. So the disciples, they were waiting for this perfect King David-style kingdom, right? What about us? What were we hoping for when we think of God's kingdom? Perhaps we might be wishing that when we carry out Jesus' commands to make disciples and we tell the gospel, it would be much easier than it is. Perhaps we wish that every time we tell the gospel, someone would come to faith and that would happen. Sometimes it does, right? Sometimes when we tell the gospel, it does, but not always. And that might get us asking, why not? Why doesn't that happen always? And the answer is because the kingdom is hidden now. The kingdom is hidden now. People haven't yet seen it for what it is. People reject it without realizing what they're rejecting. It's not yet this visibly all-powerful, all-encompassing kingdom that it will one day be. It's not that yet. And so right now, doing kingdom work, doing mission, can be hard. There can be rejection. There can be trouble. We're not at that huge tree stage yet, that stage when Jesus returns. So what's Jesus' point in all this? I think one of the things he's saying here is don't be fooled by appearances. Don't be fooled by appearances. When you see the kingdom looking apparently weak, don't be fooled. When you see people reject the kingdom, when you tell the gospel, when others tell the gospel and they reject it, don't be fooled. When you see kingdom people suffer for obeying Jesus, imprisoned, treated unfairly, injustice, don't be fooled by that. When you see people opposed to Jesus in control in this world, in political power in this world, don't be fooled. When you see John the Baptist imprisoned or followers of Jesus today imprisoned, don't be fooled. The kingdom will be great. It will be powerful. The tiny seed will become the largest plant. That little bit of yeast will permeate everything. That will happen. What is small and weak and hidden now will be glorious then. So my son is 11 years old, and when he was a bit younger, I first started watching sporting games. I'd sit down with him and I'd say, "So Liam, tell me, who are you following? Who are you supporting in this game?" And he would always say, "I'm not sure yet, Dad." And I'd keep asking him as the game went on. And usually in the last 5 or so minutes, when it was really clear who was going to win, he'd say, "Yeah, I'm going for that team." He doesn't do that now. He's latched onto Sydney Thunder and he's really excited about them. So he goes for them even when they lose now. But that's what he was like. And I think Jesus is saying here, don't be like my son with those sporting games. Don't do that with the kingdom. Don't hold back now. Don't be a handbrake Christian. Don't wait and see what becomes of it. Because in this age, the kingdom is hidden. We need to realize what it's going to become, and then we need to throw everything we have into it now. No holding back. If we share Jesus with a friend, with a colleague, with a neighbor, if we share Jesus and they reject us, don't let that put you off. Don't conclude, "Oh, well, I'm not a Jesus sharer. Then that didn't work." Keep sharing. Keep sharing with them, share with others. If we live out the kingdom values, living out, demonstrating the love of Christ by the way we live, but it causes us trouble, it causes people to make fun of us or persecute us, don't let that stop us. Keep going. This was what Jesus prepared us to happen. So if we are followers of Jesus, we are backing the winning team, even if it might not always feel like that or look like that. During this age, God is building his kingdom gradually as people like you and me show and tell the gospel. So let's keep doing that. Okay, so today we're asking the question, what is the kingdom like? And we've already seen that first point now, and that is that it's hidden. It's hidden now. Let's have a look at the second one. The second one is that it's worth it. What's the kingdom like? It's worth it. Jesus tells two more parables to teach this point. I'm going to read from verses 44 to 46. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. So back then there were no banks as we know banks now. So what people did with their wealth was sometimes they just hid it, even in a field. And this was particularly the case if there was war happening. If there was an invading army coming, you would hide whatever wealth or treasure you had in a field to make sure the enemy didn't get it. But of course, sometimes when that invading army happened, what happened? The invading army would kill the person who'd hidden the treasure, and then no one would know about the treasure. So this isn't like complete fantasy from Jesus, this idea of a treasure being hidden in a field. It did happen that sometimes someone would stumble across a forgotten treasure that had been unclaimed and buried by someone who died. So in this parable, you've got this worker. He's sent to do some work in a field. It's someone else's field. He stumbles across this treasure. Wow. He instantly realizes the value of this. This is worth so much. It's worth more than anything else I have put together. So what does he do? He hides it again to make sure no one else finds it. He sells everything he owns. He buys the field so that what's in the field is his and the treasure becomes his. That's the very short parable. Now, I just want to say this is not a lesson in ethics from Jesus. So if you find something, Jesus is not teaching us here, this is the way to go. What is Jesus teaching us here? He's teaching us what the kingdom is like. This is what the kingdom is like. It is something of immeasurable value. But at the same time, something that's hidden, something that's hidden, something that not everyone sees its value. It's valuable, but it's hidden. But if we have eyes to see, for those of us who recognize just how valuable the kingdom is, it's worth giving up everything to be part of it. No sacrifice can be too great. That's what the kingdom is like. The kingdom is worth it. Now, the next parable makes the same point. This time we've got a wholesale pearl dealer. He's on a professional trip. He's looking for pearls for his business. And when he finds the one, he's happy to sell everything he's got just to get his hands on it. That's what the kingdom's like. It's worth it. It's worth more than everything we have, everything else that we have combined. Becoming a kingdom person, living out kingdom ways, it might actually cost us a lot. It might actually involve great sacrifice. To be taking Jesus, God's mission in the world, to be taking it seriously might cost us a lot. In fact, if you read through the Gospel of Matthew, you'll see lots of warnings from Jesus about what the costs might be if you go on mission with him, as he calls us to. He says, "Follow me and you take up your cross," which is another way of saying you'd be willing to die. "Follow me and you leave everything behind," he says to some people. "Follow me and you may have no place to lay your head," he says to his disciples at one point. "Follow me," he says to one guy, "sell everything you have and give it to the poor." "Follow me," he says in chapter 16, "and you lose your life." And it wasn't just the case for his followers back then. Following Jesus today can involve great sacrifices. We seek to carry out his mission. We might be rejected, we might be mocked, we might be made fun of, we might be ostracized, we might bring trouble on ourselves, we might be worse off financially. We might also bring someone to faith and have a new friend for eternity. Wonderful, wonderful, praise God. But even if all those hard sacrifice things happen as well, the message here is that it's worth it. It's worth it. It's infinitely more worth infinitely more than all the things that we might lose, all the sacrifice or suffering that might come our way. So I said I'd finish this guy's story before. So this is Anto, the guy who shared the gospel. Husband and wife came to faith, and when he went back to disciple them, there were these threats: come back here again and we'll kill you. So I remember I was mentoring Anto, and we would meet regularly to read the Bible, and he told me this story. He said, I don't know what to do. Should I go back? These new believers, I really want to follow them up, but the neighbourhood is so angry about what's happened that they've threatened to kill me. What should I do? Well, we said, let's look for an answer in God's word, and we read these parables here in Matthew 13, 44 to 46. And I said, what do you think Jesus would say to you about this question, whether you should go back and disciple these new believers or not? And he said, Jesus would say, yes, you might face trouble if you do that, but it's worth it. The kingdom is worth it. And so he did. He was very brave. He organized to meet this couple. He didn't go back to their house where the angry mob had met him last time. He arranged to meet them in a separate place nearby. And he followed them up. And he discipled them. And a couple of months later, that new couple went to him and said, life is really hard for us since we became followers of Jesus. We're finding it really hard economically because people don't want to interact with us business-wise anymore because we're followers of Jesus. We're finding it hard socially and family-wise because of the rejection and persecution we're getting. And we're considering just going back to being Muslim again. And so Anto sat down with them and did the same thing that I had done with Anto. They opened up Matthew 13, they read these parables, and he asked them, what would Jesus say to you in this situation? And they said something very similar. They'd say, yes, it's hard, but it's worth it. The kingdom is worth it. And they persevered too. It's worth it. The kingdom is worth it. Have you ever struggled with handbrake Christian syndrome? That handbrake Christian idea where you hear the radical commands of Jesus, but you hold back from fully obeying them and carrying them out because of the fear of what it might cost, the fear of what you might lose. If you've ever experienced that, and I certainly have, I think we have something really wonderful and valuable here to help us with that. So these two parables here, I think they helped us to see that our problem deep down might be that we think all those other things that we have in life, maybe comfort or safety or a good job or a house or an income or friends, all good things, but we think deep down that they are the most important things for us. And that might be why we are so keen to hold on to them at all costs. And what Jesus would say to us here is we need to recognize how valuable the kingdom is. More valuable than all those other good things put together. Because when we understand that, then we'll be willing to risk those things for the sake of the kingdom, for the sake of carrying out this kingdom work that God has given us. Then we'll be more and more willing to sacrifice the more we understand how valuable the kingdom is. In fact, it won't even be a begrudging, oh, okay, I have to. It'll be a joyful thing. Did you notice in verse 44 it says, in his joy he went and sold everything. Once we recognize how valuable the kingdom is, it'll be a joyful thing to be able to sacrifice for the sake of participating in God's mission. So if you do find yourself holding back, if you do feel like the handbrake is on in some way, I would encourage you not just to grit your teeth and try harder to obey, not to feel guilty. I just want to encourage you to to focus on the kingdom and how valuable it is. Because it's when we see that, the more our understanding of its values grows, the more we'll grow in our desire to be willing to sacrifice to participate in God's mission there. Okay, so our question today has been, what is the kingdom like? We've had two answers so far, haven't we? The first one was, it's hidden. The second one just now was, it's worth it. And the last one is this, and that is that it's coming. The kingdom is coming. I'm just going to read the last parable from Jesus, from verse 47. The last parable that we're looking at. Once again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was let down into the lake and caught all kinds of fish. When it was full, the fishermen pulled it up on the shore. Then they sat down and collected the good fish in baskets, but threw the bad away. This is how it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come and separate the wicked from the righteous and throw them into the fiery furnace where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Last point, it's coming. The kingdom is coming. So right now, the good fish and the bad fish, that is the people who've accepted Jesus and those who've rejected Jesus, right now they're all swimming together in the same sea, says Jesus in this parable. But one day, a day will come when all those fish will be dragged up in a net and they'll be tipped out onto the beach, which is what they used to do in those days, and then they'll be sorted. That's what the fishermen used to do. They'd lay out their catch, they'd sort the good from the bad. And Jesus is saying that's what the angels will do on that final day. Now, while it's still hidden, we don't see that. But on those days, people who rejected the kingdom, they will enter into a horrible eternity. But on that day, those who recognized the kingdom, even though it was hidden, those who followed Jesus, those who sacrificed for the kingdom because they knew it was worth it, those people will enter into a perfect eternity. So what's the point? The point is, don't hold back now. Live for the kingdom now in light of that day. It is coming. The kingdom is coming. Yes, there are mixed responses now. Yes, there's rejection sometimes, trouble sometimes, suffering sometimes. But a day is coming when the kingdom will be revealed. So as I wrap things up now, I just want to ask you the same question that I've been asking others since we got back to Australia last year, and that is, what's it like being a Christian? What's it like being a kingdom builder, someone on mission with God in Australia these days, 21st century post-Christian Australia? How are you finding that? What's it like for you? Is there rejection and trouble for you as you seek to carry out God's mission? Does that lead you to fear and to doubt? Do you find evidence of handbrake Christian syndrome going on in your life? Well, Jesus has been helping us, equipping us, training us today through the words of these parables to help us understand what the kingdom is like. Because when we understand that, we're ready to be on mission with him. The kingdom is hidden. The kingdom is worth it. And the kingdom is coming. That's what we've seen today. And when we, the more we realise that, the more that soaks in to our hearts and to our minds, the more we'll be unleashed to not hold back, to not play it safe, to take risks for God on mission in all sorts of ways. I don't know what this is going to mean for you in your context. I can see that you're very globally engaged, which is wonderful. It might mean financial sacrifice for you there. I also understand that you've got a real passion for local mission here. You'll be the ones to work out what this means. I guess what I want to bring to you today is this idea that we focus on the value of the kingdom, and that releases us to do brave things for the kingdom as people, as Jesus' people, as God's people, to sell everything that we have to buy that field. I just want to finish with one final story. This is a story of another student, which helps us to see some of the things that we've been learning today. I'm going to call this student Custo. I don't use their real names in stories like this. Custo was from a family from another religion. His father, when Custo was a child, his father came to faith in Christ. And his community was very angry about this, and they persecuted the family in many ways. Custo vividly remembers the day when people used to throw rocks in at his house, and one day a big boulder was thrown. It was so big and it landed just right next to him. And when he told me that story, he had tears in his eyes, saying, if that boulder had been 1 metre in the other direction, I would have been killed that day. I was just a small child. So it was really strong persecution that they had. And the persecution was so difficult, and it was financial as well. These communities are often very interdependent financially, and if they're rejected, no one will trade with them. So the persecution got so bad that Custo's parents couldn't afford to keep him. And normally, and it's quite common in a country with a lot of poverty, normally a child that parents couldn't keep would be given to an uncle or a grandparent, but no one in the extended family wanted to take Custo because this was now a Christian family. So he ended up in an orphanage. And this was not a good orphanage at all. It was a terrible place, and Custo experienced all kinds of abuse in that orphanage. And after some years there, he started to really doubt Jesus. He started to wonder if Jesus was worth it. Because ever since his father had led his family to become Jesus' followers, all that had happened was bad things. And so he tells me he was ready to give it away and go back to the majority religion at the time. But then a Christian pastor started to visit this orphanage. And when everyone else around Custo had been showing him trouble, this Christian pastor brought love and kindness and hope. And slowly this Christian pastor started to teach Custo about the kingdom of God. He taught him about Jesus, he taught him about the gospel. And in the midst of all this trouble in his life, Custo found true hope. He found the true gospel of Jesus Christ. In the midst of all this trouble that was going on around him, he discovered that the gospel, the kingdom, is worth it. It's hidden now, there's trouble now, but it's worth it. And Custo grew up, went to Bible college, came to the mission training school so he could be prepared for a lifetime of living for the kingdom, of telling others of this kingdom. Because even despite all these real troubles in his life, and he still has significant scars from those experiences, he knows that the kingdom is worth it.